have one slide, which is not this one, but the next one, slightly more, slightly denser information than the first one. Well, I just want to set the stage for Zijing and Pat about what we're talking about in our visible universe, and in particular, why there's been a recent interest in using the hydrogen 21 centimeter line to map the large scale structure of the universe. This is a picture from Max's recent paper of the universe, short universe drawn to scale in co-moving coordinates. So, of course, we're in the middle, and this lays out the amount of information that there is to extract out of the universe, basically, how many co-moving modes you're going to cover. So the red regions are the where we're currently at with the Sloan LRG survey. So that's the deep part of the Sloan survey going up to redshift of a half or something like that. And you can see, you know, we're starting to make headway. We're starting to see this first BAO signal. We're starting to get into the regime of position large-scale structure mapping. We've got a long ways to go. So in principle, with the reason why 21 centimeter has been proposed by a number of authors, including myself, Matthias, Avi, Anthony, and others, is that you can see it out to a redshift of maybe as high as 50 or 60. And the number of modes, if you just ask how much information is there in this universe, well, it's limited on the small scales by the Jeans mass of the gas, of the 21 centimeter gas at the redshift of 50, let's say, when the universe is 150 Kelvin. So you put that in as your smallest scale you'll ever measure. You're limited by the Hubble radius. That's the largest scale you'll ever measure. Take the ratio in qubits, and that'll tell you how much in principle you could learn about the universe. And the answer is you could learn 10 to the 18 numbers. So if you wanted to ask, well, how much, if it's a Gaussian random field, square root of n tells me how much I can, how well I can measure a power spectrum or some other derived quantity. So hypothetically, the excitement is that I could measure something to, you know, 9 significant digits just by adding up modes. Well, there's no structure below the Jeans scale, so it's thought that it becomes exponentially harder to measure. I mean, this is pretty futuristic, okay? I'm not saying we're going to measure this all in the next 5 years, but it gets exponentially harder when there's no structure in your gas field. I think then that's why people are modest and stick to the. And not at 50. No, at 50, the Jeans scale is still linear, which is why people say let's take that as a limit. There are, of course, still many issues, both technical and theoretical and others, to be sorted out before you'll. But just to lay the ground for where the ambitious thinking theorists might be thinking in 100 years' time, or I don't know what the time scale is for this, is this is when you've reached this, you have kind of exhausted the information that you'll ever get out of this universe. Okay, so that's how far you can think about thinking. And well, if you translate this into numbers, of course, you know what you do with large scale structure. You can do gravitational lensing, measure gravity waves, measure FNL, three-point functions, BAOs, redshift distortions. This is a laundry list of standard things to do with large scale structure. You'll hear more from Zijing and Pat in a minute. If you just put square root of n statistics in, you could measure things like inflationary tensor mode ratios to 10 to minus 8. FNL to 10 minus 4. So, you know, hypothetically, this is how much you could learn within our Hubble volume about our universe. And that's why there's been interest, why there's been futuristic thinking theorists adding up these modes and saying, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful? You can really test, you know, this is, you actually see the FNL, that's the minimal FNL generated by minimal inflationary theories in principle from this. So, and then of course, you also get to learn about astrophysical, because gastrophysical things like reionization and other wonderful things. But apart from this being a futuristic picture of where you might be, we'll hear in the next two presentations, or at least from Zijing, we'll hear about an application of where we are in this quest for mapping it all out. So, how far have we gotten? And this I'll pass on to Zijing.
Get the microphone.
It's on.
Yeah, microphone is on.
Yes, it's just to be transferred.
Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Xing Cheng, and I'm going to tell you about the going cosmology with 21 centimeter intensity mapping, this idea. And this work was done with Wei-Li and Pat, and also Jeff Peterson and Kevin Bandura at Carnegie Mellon University. So just give you a very brief overview of 21 centimeter. So as you know, basically neutral hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe. And it has a very small optical depth, so it's basically transparent through the universe, so that it allows us to probe a very large volume of the visible universe, as long as the spin temperature differs from that of the CMB temperature. So in the era, what Wei-Li just talked about, basically correspond to this this period from a ratio from 30 to 150, when the spin temperature of 20 centimeter decouples from that of the CMB and cools much faster than the CMB, and so it could be seen in absorption. And from a ratio between 30 and 6, the universe undergone a period, a so-called cosmic reionization, where hydrogen transited from mostly neutral to mostly ionized. So, but then after that, the spin temperature has been heated up and coupled to the very hot gas temperature, and then we can be able to see hydrogen in emission after a ratio of 6 or so. And so this is the period where I'm going to focus on. We are trying to, where we use 21 centimeter as a probe as a tracer for large-scale structure, and use that to measure the baryon acoustic oscillation, and therefore constraining constraining cosmology. So just to tell you briefly, the H1 signal that we are looking at is about 300 microkelvin, depending on the cosmology, the underlying cosmology, and also the density fluctuations, which is a function of scale. And it also depends a lot, of course, on how much H1 there is, so which is characterized by this omega H1 parameter. And also, it's a redshift dependent. This signal is redshift dependent. So at a redshift of 1 or so, where the dark energy dominates, the 21 centimeter, where the temperature of 21 centimeter is about 300 microkelvin. Okay, and so I guess you're all pretty familiar with the baryon acoustic oscillation, the so-called BAO idea. Basically, just as the photon baryon flow has left an imprint on at the surface of large scattering on the CMB, it also left an imprint on the underlying baryons, and it is present. This oscillation oscillatory signature is present in the current large scale structure, and this signal has recently been measured with the 2DF and Sloan survey. And this signature serves as a standard ruler that allows us to measure the distance parameter and also the Hopper parameter in the redshift space. And combined with the CMB, it has emerged to be a very powerful tool for constraining the cosmology, especially the dark energy equation of state. So this is what the current result from the WMAP. Five-year result, and it's pretty impressive that combining WMAP and the BAO measurement from 2DF and Sloan, it has shrunk the contour, the omega lambda and omega curvature very significantly. So this is this red one. So right now, there are many current planned or proposed experiments that aim to measure this BAO signature, such as BOSS and undergoing, and also this most the and also such as SKA and ADAT. So here we we are proposing to not only just use 21 centimeter as this trace of logical structure, but instead using a sort of measure, we do not want to not just measure this 21 centimeter from individual galaxies, but measure the emission from a collective, measure the collective logical structure traced by H1, and without resolving the individual galaxies. So, which means we measure in each BL pixel, we measure 100 galaxy, well, H1 emissions from in this pixel. And so this is this idea we call it intensity mapping. So this is very similar to, actually very similar to CMB. So on this BL pixel scale, where we aim, because the BL signature is on very large scales, about 100 megaparsec per moving or so. So we actually do not need to go to the small scale, the sub megaparsec scale, as such as the galaxy scale. But instead, we can measure measure the collective emission on 10 megaparsec scale or so, where there are lots of where basically you're measuring a collective emission from all the galaxies or all the H1s in it. So so this is similar to the CMB idea, where you measure the H1 temperature fluctuation on a certain scale. And we can use that to measure the, then use that to still be able to measure the BL signature. So currently, currently the highest individual 21 centimeter measurement emission measure is a ratio of only 0.3. But with this intensity mapping ideas, it will allow us to access a much larger distance with a relatively with current existing technology. And I'll talk about the feasibility later. So with this idea, we want to measure, use 21 centimeter intensity mapping to measure BL wiggles between a ratio of 0 and 3. And again, this H1 signal is about 100 microkelvin or so, while there's a known foreground. There's one problem with this, is that the foreground is pretty large. There's extragalactic and galactic synchrotron radiations from the galaxy, which is at ratio of 1 or so, it's about 1 Kelvin, and with fluctuations of about 10 millikelvin. So both numbers are very large, much larger than the signal we are looking after. But hopefully the foregrounds are spectrally smooth and could be removed against this H1 line emission. So we have been proposing the idea of using a radio cylinder telescope together with this H1 intensity mapping ideas to do this BO experiment. And there's a proposal in the making. It's called CHIME, which stands for the Canadian Hydrogen Imaging Experiment, which ends for 10,000 square meters and in this redshift range. So this is the good thing about this is using current technology, and also the cost is pretty moderate, and it could happen in the near future. And just to tell you the forecast of CHIME or a similar experiment like that, so this is the space available for BLO detection. This is in redshift versus function of scale. So and this is so this we are hoping to measure up down to the third wiggles of this BLO oscillatory signal. And this part will be accessible to the BLO experiment. So this low redshift and large scales is excluded because just by the available visible universe to us. And this part is excluded by the nonlinear growth of structure that could basically erase the BLO's feature. And this part is excluded by our best guess of what the foreground could contaminate the H1 21 centimeter measurement, even with the even with the removal of the foreground.
The control part for constraining the dark energy equation of state W and W prime. And I'm not sure how we.
So why is that? Why do you ignore the rest of the information?
I guess I'm not sure if you can see, but I just want to point out the prospect for using chime. It's very similar. Constraining power is very similar to that of the dark energy tax force 3 emissions, which are still pretty far ahead in the future. This experiment seems pretty promising in terms of this cosmology constraining power. So, okay. Thank you. I'll tell you about what we know about the 21 centimeter universe at low redshift. And interestingly, it's actually not very well known because the highest measure redshift of H1 is only up to 0.3, and even higher redshift is only been observed in the so-called dense light magma systems, where they are dense cores of H1. They are thought to be dense cores of H1, and they're self-sheltered from the ionizing background. But the nature and the mass, state density, etc., such information of these systems are not very well known. But luckily, our intensity mapping idea does not care about this. Well, what we need to know is that whether H1 is actually a good tracer of larger structures, so that would enable this measurement of EAO and cosmology, etc. And also, it's not known that how much H1 there is actually in the universe beyond ratio 0.3. So in the ratio range of interest, say ratio 1 or 2, how much H1 there would be accessible to us. So we have done two tests to try to answer these questions. So one is that we try to cross-correlate two surveys. So one is the high-pass H1 survey that's measured in the very local universe up to a distance of 127 megaparsec. And this is on the right is the 6DF galaxy survey. And as you can see, the 6DF shows probably, I hope you can see that it actually shows the logical structure. And optical galaxies are known to be good tracers of the underlying logical structure. And so, but then we cross-correlate these two maps. So while you can see the logical structure on the right, on the left is H1 map. It's not, actually the two maps do not look alike, and you do not necessarily see the logical structure in H1. However, when you do the cross-correlation, you do actually see that as a function of scale, you can see that H1 and optical galaxies trace each other very well up to a distance of about 3 megaparsec. So this just as what you would expect from a galaxy-galaxy correlation. So this is a good indication that H1 is actually tracing the underlying logical structure. So another test we did is we tried to find out how much H1 there is at ratio 1, namely what is omega H1 at ratio 1. So we do this pretty similar trick by cross-correlating the some H1 data that we taken from the Green Band Telescope with the D2 galaxy survey at ratio 0.7 to 1.1. And so we measured this H1 and optical cross correlation on scales of 10 megaparsecs by in spatial dimension and 2 megaparsecs in radio scales. And this is also, again, not only just testing it, how much H1 is, but it's also a test of the idea of intensity mapping. And we found that there is indeed a zero lag, there's indeed a close correlation between optical and H1. And the at H1 temperature, we measure H1 temperature of 280 microkelvin. So it can be translated to omega H1 value of about, this is 10 to the minus 4. So the total value is about 10 to the minus 3, which is pretty consistent with other measurements that that indirect measurements of omega H1 at this redshift. So, but then this is probably, if confirmed, is probably the highest redshift, a direct measurement of H1 at the highest redshift measurement of H1. So, and then there's from the experimental side, there's a test. There's a prototype being built in Pittsburgh. They're trying to test the idea of radio cylinder and the technical challenges that could this experiment can face, such as the foreground saturation and radio frequency interference, rejection, etc. Issues that is. And but then I'll quickly just summarize here. So as you know, H1 line is a good probe of cosmology, and this intensity mapping idea enables a very offers an efficient and economical way to map out the large the BO and large scale structure. And so we have done some tests to verify this idea, and looks like currently we think that H1 is indeed a good tracer of large scale structure at low redshift, and there is a good amount of H1 at the ratio of 1 or so, and we're still working on the technical issues, and hopefully we'll hear from Chaim very soon. Thank you.
Is intensity mapping the method that people are converging for at higher redshift?
Higher redshift meaning?
Reionization.
Well, reionization. Well, basically, reionization is sort of like intensity mapping idea. Well, looking at scales, roughly it's dominated by the ionized regions, which are about 20 to 30 megaparsec. Very large fields, so it's equivalent was basically intensity mapping where you measure the fluctuation.
So you were mostly talking about baryonic acoustic oscillations, but you probe very small scales.
We probe, and by small you mean?
Well, the smaller the level of the clouds. If you look at your plot of K and redshift,
right,
what can you probe?
Right.
For redshift, you do 0.5 and 1.5. You're going to very high frequencies.
So we go to, you mean K as a function of K?
Yeah.
So we go to K of about 0.4.
Yeah.
K or 0.4, that's.
Yes. Yeah, how well you can measure spectrum?
A spectrum that's, you mean for H1, with H1 you can.
No. So is it linear or is it non linear? So,
the PL features? So we try to
measure. I'm talking about the remote spectrum. How well you can measure spectrum.
The H1 power spectrum.
No.
Linear power.
To density power spectrum. Can you translate it to the density power spectrum?
From the.
From H1.
From H1. Well, there's so hopefully H1 is a good tracer of of the underlying density, and there's no scale dependent bias.
Okay.
It's scale, it's
a better than level alpha plus.
Better than
level alpha plus.
I don't know.
It doesn't. It's really funny. This intensity mapping is really just a more efficient way to do what you can do with galaxy redshift scales. But you can go to smaller scales. You're limited by the same nonlinearity and of both just the gravitational clustering and the bias that you are with galaxies.
And still, you go further in scales. So the smaller scale relatively to what you can do with level alpha.
No.
No?
No, it's the same.
You're seeing beam climbing alpha systems, which are intrinsically at, you know, that's the object underlying the intensity of the emission. And they're intrinsically nonlinear objects. You can go smaller with the limit alpha force because you're seeing the only weakly nonlinear space in between those galaxies.
Yeah.
So if you thought you'd read that off the plot, that was just
so, okay, so you cannot improve data on the power spectrum at small scales.
But it's like having more galaxies, isn't it? Or
the projections.
Yeah, but you can't go to higher.
Don't give you an improvement over what you get from playing. I mean, the truth is, like on the slope n s, you don't get much improvement even if you want enough force over which you can the running you can do better. Okay, so I just summarized that. And one thing for a theorist to think about 21 centimeter intensity mapping is if we can deal with the foregrounds and everything and it works. What it will be is a much more efficient way to do what you normally think of doing with galaxy redshift circuits. So my talk is going to be about what you can do with galaxy redshift surveys in general, and in particular beyond BAO, because I think there's a little too much focus strictly on BAO. So my first point was going to be something that Wei Li made already, but I think I somewhat like my figure better, which shows the cumulative volume of the universe versus redshift. The Sloan luminous red galaxies, which is the largest redshift survey we have, map about 1 cubic gigaparsec. So that's down the line. So we have a huge amount of universe to map. So this is co-moving volume, which is proportional to the number of modes, Fourier modes. And it goes beyond this figure, really, because as you go to higher redshift, the nonlinear scale moves to higher k or smaller scales. So you really get more modes than even the volume gives you. And furthermore, what I'm going to talk about mostly is there's new ideas we have recently that suggest that there's a lot to be gained from going to higher signal to noise than our typical plans for galaxy surveys, redshift surveys. So the point is there's a huge amount of potential in redshift surveys. Okay, so this is a linear power spectrum function of k. When everyone's talking about the BAOs, they're talking about these measuring the scale of these small ripples. There's a lot of power spectrum other than that, which in this BAO approach is just treated as noise. And I would say that there's no compelling reason for this, for focusing so exclusively on BAO. Because it scales, the BAO scale and larger, I would say we theoretically understand the galaxy power spectrum as well as we do other dark energy probes that we're happy to use, like supernova radar clusters. Okay, so the rest of my talk is going to be on a specific application. How to use multiple traces of density with different bias, meaning different galaxy types or luminosities, to beat what you normally thought would have been the cosmic variance limit. So the original idea that this came from was this recent Seljak paper, where he applied this multi-tracer idea to measuring non-Gaussianity of the initial conditions. That's
not mainly what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about McDonald and Seljak recently. We applied this same kind of thinking to redshift space distortions due to peculiar velocities, and from that to constraining dark energy or anything else that affects the large-scale clustering. And the bottom line of this is that you can get order of magnitude improvements in measurements of the rate of growth of structure, d, d, dA of z, where d is the linear growth factor, and similar improvements in dark energy constraints, and then more. That's essentially a special case of the method. So understand what I mean by multiple galaxies with different bias. You have to know what I mean by bias, which is generally just the relationship between galaxy density and mass density, which is linear on large scales. So if you have this delta GI is the galaxy density perturbation for galaxy type I, that's equal to a bias factor, a constant, which depends on the galaxy type, times the mass density perturbation, plus maybe some noise because this relation isn't perfect. And then there may be higher order terms, which don't matter, higher order and delta, which don't matter on large in the large scale limit. From this, you can calculate the galaxy power spectrum, which is proportional to the mass power spectrum times the bias squared plus some noise, where these could have eyes on them. The noise power, which is important for this talk, is at least approximately equal to 1 over the number density of galaxies. So if you get a higher density of galaxies, you have lower noise in the mapping of the density field. So it's also another key element is the way that peculiar velocities work in large field structure. If this black line is a mass density gradient node, this red line is supposed to be the peculiar velocities associated with that mode. So this is an overdensity. You see that the velocities are converging on this overdensity, flowing out of the underdensity. This is the actual equation in linear theory for the velocities, the relation of velocity to density. The important factor here, which I'll talk about, is this F, which is d log growth factor d log A, which in typical models is approximately equal to mega matter 2.6. So in an Einstein distributed universe, this would be 1. I drew this mode a little lower amplitude than the density mode because as dark energy takes over and the mega matter gets lower, the velocities get lower relative to density. And you think this is the kind of thing you can measure. So the peculiar velocities give you redshift space distortions because your radial coordinate is a redshift or essentially a velocity. And I think basically schematically everybody probably knows how this works. Your Kaiser 1987 derived that the density of a galaxy type in redshift space, in Fourier space, is given by this formula, which is the bias plus this F times mu squared times the real space density mode, where mu is the cosine of the angle between the wave vector and your line of sight. So k parallel is a component of the wave vector along your line of sight. So mu is 1 for modes along your line of sight where the redshift space distortions at 0 transfers to your line of sight where there isn't any distortion. So black is again this just the mass density mode. The part of the note that the part of this redshift space density that comes from peculiar velocities is not dependent on the bias. It's just for radial mode, it's just F times delta K. So that's this red. The green would be for a bias 2 galaxy, what you would see transverse to your line of sight. So this is just enhanced relative to the matter by bias. Blue is a mode, a radial mode, which is enhanced both by the bias and by the redshift space component. So the multi-tracer idea is, for beating cosmic variance, is described here. So you have, suppose you have two types of galaxies with different bias, type 2 and type 1. Take the ratio of their density perturbations in redshift space. There, this is the delta 2, the galaxy 2 density. This is galaxy 1 density. In the ratio, the mass density perturbation cancels out. And so all you have is these bias and redshift space distortion factors. And this is in the no noise limit, which is useful for illustration of the effect, although in actual calculations you have to take into account the noise. So with no noise, what you have, if you measure this ratio, you just know these. There's no variance at all. You know this ratio perfectly. So here I've just rewritten this with alpha as the ratio of biases and beta as the usual F over first bias. If you think about looking at one transverse mode, mu is zero, so you can get the ratio of biases perfectly. Then you can look at, so you know alpha, you look at a radial mode, and you can solve for beta. So you know alpha and beta perfectly. So the point is there's no cosmic variance because these density fluctuations which cause the cosmic variance cancel. With small noise, the error on these measurements scales like the noise over the power. So it scales like 1 over the galaxy density. As you get higher and higher galaxy density, you can measure these things arbitrary precision. So first thing I thought what good is knowing beta to arbitrary precision? Because it still has the bias in it. It's interesting, but then if you go back to the equation for one of the galaxy densities here, if you know beta, you can solve for B1 in terms of beta and F and plug it in here. And what you get is beta inverse plus mu squared, both of which you know, or at least right now I'm saying you know. You don't know mu perfectly because you don't know the geometric factors to convert angle to velocity, but that's something I'll come back to later. So you know these factors, then times F delta. So what you have is, if you measure beta perfectly, a perfect measurement of F times delta, which is proportional to the velocity divergence. And you can use this to measure P theta, the velocity divergence power spectrum, which is the mass power spectrum times F squared, or d log a. So you have an entirely eliminated cosmic variance. You have entirely eliminated cosmic variance at this point. But you have entirely eliminated the degeneracy with bias that you normally have in the galaxy redshift surface, so that you have what you would have obtained if you could, say, observe velocity divergence directly. And you can use that to constrain cosmology, dark energy, or whatever. So this shows how well this kind of thing can, in principle, work. Hopefully, 21 centimeters is one way that can help actually make this a reality. This is thinking of three quarters of the sky surveys up to whatever redshift. The green lines are just single tracers. So you always could, just by looking at the angular dependence of the power spectrum, disentangle the bias part and the redshift space distortion part. Like, we lost a lot of information that way. And this shows how much that was. Green is just single tracers, so a single type of galaxy, what you would have always thought of doing. The top line is bias of 2. The second line is a bias of 1. One thing that's kind of interesting to know here is that you do better in redshift space distortions with lower bias. In contrast to the Diego surveys are always designed to try to have high bias. That's because changing the bias doesn't help you, doesn't make the redshift space, the velocity part any bigger. It just, increasing the bias just adds more of the noise part that you, or the bias part that you're not interested in. So the black lines then are when you use this multi-tracer approach. So you have both the bias equals two and bias equals one tracers, and this is signal to noise of 1, 3, 10, 30, 100, and red is what you would get if you had truly perfect tracers. And so these are the fractional errors on P theta in these in bins of width 0.2 in redshift.
So can I ask you something? So you're assuming that your noise is uncorrelated, right?
That it's on the scale you're looking at, it's white.
It's white. How would an approximate? Because I imagine that would be if you have more and more galaxy.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's quite true because you know that on the scale of nonlinearity, galaxies are fragmented. So if you maybe have infinite number of galaxies, you still have some finite shot nodes because all these galaxies within the 10 megaparsec product.
Yes.
So does that somehow come in?
There will. On large scales, that where large is roughly this usual nonlinear, perturbative nonlinear scales. On scales larger than that, there's good reason to believe that the noise should be white. There may be a limit below which you can't, there may be a lower limit on the level of white noise. But on very large scales, the noise should be white, basically just because the galaxy formation process is local. So as long as it's finite, as long as the galaxy formation randomness has finite range, it has to produce white noise. That's a different talk.
So I realize that. I guess we've talked about this before. But I imagine there would be a fundamental limitation to doing this is that if you have more galaxies than within the short range interaction of, you have more than one galaxy within a sphere of megaparsec, right? Then that doesn't help you anymore. Because all those are correlated to each other.
This is motivation to study where that limit should be. But one thing, BAO surveys are very typically designed very sparse.
Uh-huh.
The Sloan main galaxies, which is just the most standard typical galaxy survey, is more than a factor of 10 denser already than a typical BAO survey plan. And one over n shot one seems to work pretty well for them. So yeah, there'll probably be a limit. You might not be able to get to 100, but you probably can get to 10 or 30, and I'm not sure you can't get to 100. This is something that needs to be, this should motivate studying. Anyway, so you can do this measurement, and Andy talked about how we quantify how useful this is for constraining dark energy. So I'm just going to use the straight out of the box original dark energy task force figure of merit for basically all the reasons he talked about. That it's just useful and it's not general, but it's a good standard thing to do. This plot shows the actual parameter dependence of p theta theta at a certain k. It's the derivative of log p theta theta with respect to the parameter, multiplied by a typical error on the parameter that comes from Planck, basically, and stage two dark energy, and this figure up to z of one. But that's a detail. These errors are one case of the last figures where I have p theta theta error as a function in bands as a function of z. It's the signal to noise of 10 case. When I say signal to noise, that's the noise power relative to the signal power on the BAO scale. So what you see is different parameters that this is useful in constraining. It's not useful in constraining everything. Like I didn't include the varying density, the sound horizon scale at the CMB or the scalar spectral index because this isn't very helpful. These are the dark energy parameters, so it's obvious that this will help a lot. You have to know exactly how much you have to put all of this into a Fisher matrix because the parameters, there's degeneracy between Fisher matrix calculations because there's degeneracy between the parameters. And when you do that, this is what you get. So this is adding p theta theta constraints of the kind k calculated from these three-quarter sky surveys up to some z to a baseline, which is Planck plus the Dark Energy Task Force stage two constraints. And this shows the figure of merit divided by this baseline figure of merit. So blue is what you would get with the same survey, but only using the BAO information. You can, with a three-quarter sky survey, improve the figure of merit by about a factor of 10. Green here is, again, what you get by just adding the same survey, but treated as a single tracer. So this is something we always would have planned to do, but maybe then focus mostly on the BAO aspect of these surveys. Black, then, is the multi-tracer improvement as a function of the signal-to-noise you can achieve. So for, this is for a two sort of populations of bias, 2 and 1, and signal-to-noise of 1, 3, 10, 30, 100, and then the maximum possible. So just to put these figure of merit numbers in context, the best case up here, you'd be measuring W02 to 0.0023 at 1 sigma. If you had signal noise of 10 and Z max of 2, that would be, would give you W0 to 0.0074. So you get, this shows improvements in a similar scenario, inverse variance improvements on the parameters individually. You get a lot of improvement on the dark energy equation state parameters and the curvature, omega lambda. I don't know where my cyan line is. It's here. A is the amplitude of the primordial power spectrum. You get some improvement on that. Because remember, P theta has a power spectrum in it. And then the matter density, you get some improvement over Planck. The others, you get nothing over Planck, basically. So I said this wasn't a completely general analysis. It was just isolating this redshift space distortion P theta theta measurement and ignoring things like fact that you don't know the angular diameter distance to convert an observed angle to a co-moving distance, or the Hubble parameter as a function of redshift to convert a velocity to a co-moving megaparsec distance. This figure includes all the information in the power spectrum. So the BAO, redshift space distortions, geometric things like AP, how the parameters affect the transfer function. For similar three-quarter sky surveys up to some Z max. And this shows, if you compare to the previous figure, compared to this figure, you get substantial improvement from this extra information, even in the single tracer case. This is BAO here. And as you increase the signal to noise and use multi-tracers, you can increase the figure of merit even more. One interesting, although I'm not sure 100% relevant to the real world fact, is that now the improvement you can get actually increases without bound. And you can actually see how that happens when the redshift space distortions interact with the AP type effect, basically. This may not be achievable in any realistic signal to noise level. But in any case, you get a big improvement over what you would have had with BAO. I've also included the Dark Energy Task Force approximate SNAP, optimistic versions of SNAP or LST relensing. If you just add them to the baseline, there are these red dashed lines. If you add them to the weakest of these, the lowest single tracer galaxy survey, you get to these.
So the redshift dependence in the hole is only from your things you're adding.
This is the max of your galaxy, of
your survey, and these surveys are the metal.
Yeah, this is flat because I just took the
Fisher. Put the numbers. Makes sense.
This. Yeah, so this is very powerful, and before 21 centimeters, the real connection to 21 centimeters, before the 21 centimeter intensity mapping idea, I might have thought this was a little too futuristic to be exciting. But if the 21 centimeter intensity mapping idea works, you can control the foreground, it will be very easy and efficient to get maps to high signal to noise over large fractions of this of the observable volume and really make this kind of thing realistic. And so summary, there's a lot more to redshift surveys than GAO. We've only surveyed a tiny fraction of the co-moving volume and an even smaller fraction of the linear modes. There's this possibility of using multiple tracers with different bias to change or remove cosmic variance limits, or what you would have thought the cosmic variance limits were. And this pushes you to surveys with higher number density. And 21 centimeter surveys are a way, hopefully, to do this.
So are there any further questions?
What about velocity bias?
Can you think of a way to create very large scale velocity bias?
Yeah.
How's that?
I'm not sure that this has any impact whatsoever, but if you use the infamous peak patch picture, you get, because objects are preferentially forming in regions which are of larger scale, lower or deeper potential wells, that develops a different velocity bias structure than you get if it's just moving along with a universal flow. Now, can't think off the top of my head is whether this would have an impact on the beta parameter, making it non-universal. So it's something to look at, and obviously we'll look at it back at CETA.
Yeah.
So we have NIAS.